Justice Patrick Crooks, and to my immediate left is Justice John Wilcox, and I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice, and to my right is Justice William Babich, and to his right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and on the far right is our own hometown justice from Appleton and Outagamie County, Justice David Prosser. So we are now ready, after these introductions, to call our third case for today, 01-1692, In Re, the Termination of Parental Rights of Preston T.B., Sheboygan County Department of Health and Human Services versus Julie A.B. Mary T. Wagner, Assistant District Attorney of Sheboygan, Wisconsin, will represent the Sheboygan County Department of Health and Human Services. Attorney Ronald Sonderhaus of K&K Law Firm of Brookfield will represent Julie A.B., and then Ms. Wagner will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Ms. Wagner, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, ma'am. May I please the court? My name is Mary Wagner. I'm an Assistant District Attorney for Sheboygan County, Wisconsin. I represent the Sheboygan County Department of Health and Human Services in this action. This case concerns the department's petition to terminate the parental rights of an individual identified here as Julie to her son, Preston. Preston will be 4 years old this week and has spent more than the last 2 years in foster care. At the time of the disposition, Preston was 3 years old and had been living with the foster parents who wanted to adopt him for more than a year. The department sought termination based on allegations of alcohol and drug abuse and child neglect and Julie's repeated jail sentences imposed for her behavior after Preston was first put in foster care. The formal grounds for termination were a continuing need for protection and services. After a fact-finding hearing, a jury determined the grounds for termination existed. The trial court then entered the finding of parental unfitness required by the statute. A dispositional hearing was held where the department, Julie's attorney, and the guardian ad litem all agreed that the best interest of the child was the standard that should determine the court's disposition under Wisconsin Statutes 48.427. After the dispositional hearing, the trial court dismissed the petition without considering Preston's best interest, only Julie's behavior. In reaching his decision, the judge relied on language from the case of BLJ versus Polk County DHSS, which he read as requiring him first to decide whether the parent's unfitness was egregious enough to warrant termination. Only then, if that was the case, was he supposed to look to the best interests of the child. We appealed the trial court's decision, and the Court of Appeals upheld it. The Court of Appeals based its ruling on State versus Kelly S., which it had decided only recently before, where it established a two-part test for finding parental unfitness. According to the court in Kelly S., the trial court considers the child's best interest only after it separately decides that the parent's conduct is egregious enough to warrant termination. In particular, the Kelly S. test is that the trial court should consider if the ability to parent is undermined. Then, if that is the case, whether this inability is seriously detrimental to the child.
Ms. Wagner, let me, if I might, interrupt for just a minute. I know that you just got finished indicating that the judge here, Judge Bolgert, did not give any consideration to the best interests of the child. And yet, my understanding is that the trial record reflects the fact, the dispositional hearing reflects the fact, that he said the termination of contact between Julie and Preston is not essential to the child's safety or welfare. It seems to me that he is giving consideration not only to the interests of Julie, but also the interests of Preston. Why do you feel that he gave no interest and no concern to the best interests of the child?
Because in his reasoning in relying on BLJ, he indicated that the best interest of the child did not have to be reached if that termination was not determined to be egregious enough to warrant termination. I believe that is on page 3 or 4 of the fact-finding hearing.
Well, the Court of Appeals indicated that they felt that implicit in everything he said was clearly consideration of the best interests of the child. Now, I take it you must disagree with that. Why do you disagree with it?
Judge Bolgert indicated that the true test of unfitness was something other than what was found in the statutes. The Court of Appeals, in this case, relying on Kelly S., followed that two-part test of unfitness established in Kelly S., which is that the trial court must first evaluate the parental unfitness after the fact-finding hearing, after the per se finding of unfitness has been entered, and still determine whether it is egregious enough to warrant termination or is seriously detrimental to the child. Then it goes forward to consider the trial or the best interest of the child. And that, I believe, is a two-part process that is not authorized by the statutes. And also, it focuses at that point to make an analysis simply on whether the parent's ability, after the fact-finding, after the finding of unfitness, the per se on finding of unfitness, to go back and revisit the jury's findings at that point, focuses still on the parent's behavior or modification of behavior or circumstances at a time when the child's best interest is supposed to be the driving force in this consideration.
Well, counsel, did he not use the magic words in the best interest of the child? He did not use those words.
Actually, he went 90 degrees or 180 yeah. degrees apart from those.
Okay. Now, I think one of the concerns in just reading, and this is on page 6 of your opposing counsel's brief to us, it says that he talks about the time that the mother, Julie, had spent most of her time in jail, and I think the true test of unfitness is what she does after she's had the ability, she has the ability to attempt to meet those conditions upon release from jail. And then he says, since being released, she started the Genesis program. She has regularly visited the child. As I read this, I see the concern of the judge expressed not only for the child in the best interest of the child, but as far as the mother in this case being able to meet the conditions because she was incarcerated, and he goes on to say that she has been making progress, and I think that's what he was, from what I read, she was making progress in that area. Now, are you saying that a judge who has the discretion can never make a decision such as this, or he has to make the decision in a certain order?
I believe that he has to make the decision with the best interest of the child being the pole star of his determination, being the guiding prevailing factor, which is articulated in 48.426. If he decides based on the parent's behavior or circumstances without considering the child's best interest, I believe this is clearly in violation of that statutory guideline.
Now, what's the issue in this case?
Whether and when the trial court may discretionarily dismiss the petition whether and when he has to apply the best interest of the child in making his decision, whether any of the dispositions under 4827, including the discretionary dismissal of the petition, are guided from the get-go after the fact-finding is over, after the per se finding of unfitness has been entered, and after the court, as in this case, had found an evidentiary basis to sustain the jury's verdict. Whether from that point on, at the dispositional phase, the best interest of the child found in 48.426 guides each and every one of those determinations.
Is the issue in this case, as you see it, whether or not the court erred without making specific findings? Is that what you think the issue is?
No, Your Honor. I believe the trial court did not think he had to make specific findings because he did not need to reach the child's best interest.
As I understand, we're not dealing with magic words in this case. We're dealing with framework.
Yes.
We're dealing with what's the framework of analysis. As I understand the law, prior to Kelly S., if you look at our judicial bench books, for instance, and you look at our opinions, last year's opinion, Evelyn C.R. versus Tequila. It was a two-step process. The termination of parental rights involved the jury trial, and then the second step was the court determination, which took into consideration the best interests of the child. Not into consideration. That is the pole star. That is, under the statute, what you do. And that's what our recent case and Evelyn said you do. Now, Kelly comes along and rather than make it a two-step process, it's now a three-step process. And as I understand it, you have the jury trial, but rather than the judge just take as part of his framework what's in the best interest of the child, now with Kelly, there's a threshold question. And that deals with the egregiousness of the parent's activity. Was this egregious enough? And so it's changed our structure and how we approach involuntary terminations of parental rights. That's what I understand your argument to be, and that case wasn't reviewed by us, and this is, in essence, an opportunity to review not only this case, but the case upon which it is based. Kelly, is that what your argument
Honor.
Is?
Yeah. Well, that's let's just track the framework, because we can't tell whether the trial judge erroneously exercised discretion if we don't know what this framework is, okay? So I'm going to start you out as did Justice Bradley. The fact finder, whether it's jury or judge, here it was a jury, determines whether or not the parent is unfit under the standards of the statute, right?
Essentially, yes. The jury finds that grounds for termination exist, and then pursuant to the statute, the judge enters the per se finding of unfitness under 48.424.
But the judge might very well say that regardless of how the jury came out, that there aren't enough facts sufficient to support the jury.
This is true, Your Honor. That, I believe, would be a judgment notwithstanding the verdict, and if, in fact, the burden had not been met by clear and convincing evidence, the judge, in any case, would be able to set aside the jury's verdict. In this case, however, he did find that there was an evidentiary basis.
Okay, and that was a distinct, separate finding.
Yes.
All right. So in the first stage...
I could give you the cite, if you like.
Pardon me?
Would you like the cite to the record?
Sure.
Okay. That will be the record 67374.
Okay, thank you, counsel. So that's the first step here. Now, again, along with Justice Bradley, I thought the second step would be accepting the jury's finding and that the ultimate conclusion of unfit parent. The judge then decides what is the appropriate disposition.
Yes, Your Honor.
Using the best interest of the child standard.
As its prevailing
consideration.
That's
your view.
That's, I believe, the language of the statute in 426.
That's right. So where did Kelly come up with, as I understand Kelly, which relied on BLJ, Kelly divided the disposition into two parts. Is that right?
Yes.
The disposition proceeding. One... was the ability to function as a parent undermined?
Yes, that was the first test.
Where did they get that test? From BLJ only?
I'm not sure. I know they relied both on BLJ in the case of Mrs. R versus Mr. and Mrs. B, which was decided by the Wisconsin Supreme Court in 1981. I believe the Court of Appeals relied somewhat in error on the case of Mrs. R because I do not believe it truly applies to these. I don't believe it brings much to the table in these since it was decided on a set of statutes that predated the overhaul of the Children's Code in 1979 and saw the establishment of a per se finding of unfitness.
Well, I'm not very bothered by saying is the ability to function as a parent undermined, because that could be all part of what kind of disposition it should be. I mean, it's just one factor.
If it is considered simultaneously alongside with the best interest of the child, I think it's perfectly appropriate question to ask.
Okay. Now, the second part of the BLJ is, if the ability to function a parent has been undermined,
then the trial court must determine whether further contact between the child and parent will be detrimental to the child. Do you find anything the matter with that?
Your Honor, those words are as true today as they were when they were first written by the High Courts of England in the late 1800s. They go back to the case of BLJ, which took them straight from Lemon versus Lorimer in 1900, which went to a more extensive discussion of Markwell versus Perellas in 1897, which again reached the common law of England for its guidance. They stand at the foundation of what is at stake in a termination proceeding. Of course, termination should only be undertaken if a child is having things happen to its serious detriment. Of course, should only be done if it is essential to the child. But that language also connects these cases back to a time when children were considered property, when a parent had a legal right to the services and labor of his child, and when the common law largely governed these. And I would ask the court today to take that language and set it aside the language of Statute 48.415, which is the grounds for termination, and ask if it is not the modern-day legislative equivalent of the same thing. Are not each and every one of these grounds for termination, considered by the legislature after considerable debate, aren't each and every one of these things, the homicide of the other parent, the abuse, the felony against a child, the abandonment, aren't all of these on their face something that is of serious detriment to a child and their absence essential to that child's welfare?
So
that language, there's nothing wrong with that language, but it does not supplant the actions of or the directives of the statute of the Children's Code.
So you don't think detrimental to the child equals best interest of the child?
Right. It's something that has to be, as I said, it's the bedrock, it's what is at stake, and a common sense analysis of what is at stake. But it does not remove the directives of the statutes 48.426, imposing the best interest of the child as the factor that controls the disposition once the fact-finding has occurred.
So what do you expect this court to write? If you were going to write the opinion for this court, what would you write to guide future trial courts?
Well, in this particular single case, I would ask that the trial court's judgment be reversed, the dismissal of the petition be reversed, that the case be remanded back to the trial court for a new dispositional hearing to be held, because obviously a year has elapsed.
But what is the standard that the trial court is
to set? That the trial court be directed to apply the standard in 48.426, the best interest of the child standard, to any disposition that it reaches. And in terms of the larger area of the law to give guidance, to somehow reconcile or address the language in State v. Kelly S. In connection with the statute and what they require, and also with your own holdings in Evelyn C.R. versus Tequila S., where you did indeed describe the termination procedure as a two-step.
Counsel, what if, in a hypothetical case, the judge determines that termination is in the best interest of the child, but also determines that the unfitness of the parents is insufficiently egregious to warrant termination? Now what happens?
It has been embedded in Wisconsin law since the statutes of 1849 that unfitness is an absolute prerequisite before termination may occur. And so, as the Supreme Court correctly decided in the case of Mrs. R. versus Mr. and Mrs. B., to put the best interest before finding of unfitness, put the cart before the horse. If the unfitness is not there, the best interest cannot control the disposition. To think otherwise would put at risk any family that is poor and has relatives who are better off or have a more stable home. In fact, this was the situation exactly addressed in Mrs. R. case, where it was a single mother who had changed her mind about giving up her child for adoption to her sister and her brother-in-law. Mm-hmm. This was not a case where the government stepped in and said, this is the child in peril that deserves protection. This was actually a private action because the sister and brother-in-law wanted the baby. And the Supreme Court, even though the statutes at that time allowed for this disposition, for the best interest of the child to control without a finding of unfitness, the Supreme Court correctly said no.
I'm going to ask the question a little differently.
you found unfitness here. We're done with that stage.
Yes.
And now it's disposition, and suppose the judge says this is insufficiently egregious to terminate parental rights, but it's in the best interest to terminate. That's Justice Babbage's question. But we've found her unfit, or found him unfit. That's done, and we have found that there's sufficient evidence. Now, can you make those two? Can a trial court judge make these two findings?
My confusion is, I know that unfitness is required, but there seems to be a requirement in our law that unfitness isn't enough, but the judge has to find that it's sufficiently egregious.
I believe that's in context, though, with everything.
Okay, well, what I'm trying to get at, and what the chief is you can have a situation where you've got conduct of the parent that is unfit, but it's not sufficiently unfit. It's not egregious enough. Now what happens?
If I could offer a couple of contrasting hypotheticals for the court that would illustrate the point that I'm trying to make here, where it is so important for the trial court's discretion to be in play in here, to be able to assess the situation and the best interest of the child, taking in connection with everything surrounding it. Imagine a case of child abuse. We know how bad it can get. We've all read the papers, the horrible things that parents can take, actions that they can do to their children. And if, say, you have a 13-year-old child who, in the last couple of years, life has gone to hell, the parent has visited abuse on the child, termination proceedings have taken place, fact-finding has gone on, unfitness has been established. But imagine that up until that point, perhaps the preceding 11 years, there has been a strong bond between parent and child. The parent undergoes finally what would you call an 11th hour conversion and evinces a sincere desire to change. There's a large supporting extended family that would be of benefit to the child to stay connected to, and there are community services that can actually work to turn this around. It might, in that case, despite really terrible things that happen, be in that particular child's best interest to stay connected to the parent. However, if, imagine, say, a child who's 3 years old who has spent most of his life in foster care, who does not have a strong parent and child bond, whose parent has not demonstrated by conduct or action a sincere desire to change, there is no large extended family, perhaps the community services are not as good as they are in the next county, and imagine perhaps that child has special needs like a physical handicap or a mental handicap or a severe learning disability. In that case, even though perhaps this case was decided on neglect rather than abuse, that the circumstances, the grounds for termination are less objectively egregious, in that particular case, it would perhaps serve that child's best interest to be adopted rather than returned to the parent. And as this court has noted, the best interest of the child is defined in relation to the child.
Could I ask a question here? 48.426, standards and factors. It talks about the best interest of the child, and it lists some components of best interest of the child. 48.427.2, which you're familiar with, is that an additional factor, or is that something that is woven into the interpretation of 48.426? Or is that a direction to the court?
I've just lost the thought. I'm sorry. I don't have the statute in front of me. I believe 48.427.2 was the discretionary dismissal.
Best interest of the child. These are standards and factors.
Yes.
Should we clip out this subsection 2 from 427 and say, here's another factor to consider?
Being?
The court may dismiss the petition if it finds that the evidence does not warrant the termination of parental rights. Is that a factor?
No, Your Honor. I believe that is just one of the dispositions available to the trial court in the exercise of discretion. But that exercise of discretion is still bound by the best interest.
Okay. Now I wasn't here in 1991, so I'm not wedded to some of these past decisions except as precedent that should be honored.
did this BLJ case kind of confuse the law? And isn't it not solely Kelly S., is it? Didn't the BLJ kind of muddy up the law a little bit?
At the risk of being undiplomatic, a little, I believe.
I think you can go further than that.
Pardon?
It was a Court of Appeals decision. Okay. Feel free.
No, it wasn't.
Well, Kelly S. definitely
confused. Is Court of Appeals.
Kelly S. confused the heck out of things, but in BLJ, well, actually, a lot of the smoke and the noise about this whole serious detriment to the child, essential to the child's safety and welfare, misses the central holding, I believe, of BLJ, which is that per se finding of unfitness under 48.424.4 is constitutional and comports with due process. Mrs. R. is not relevant to that because it was decided under a different set of statutes. That amidst all this discussion of whether something is seriously detrimental or how much more analysis you do of unfitness, the fact is BLJ upheld the constitutionality of that law, which was new at the time, which said that if these conditions are met, any of those conditions, grounds for termination under 48.415, this constitutes something that is bad enough that justifies the drastic intervention of the state to terminate the bond between parent and child. BLJ did not really address or talk in terms of the best interest of the child. BLJ talked in terms of the constitutionality of 48 point, I forget anyway, this per se finding of unfitness. And then it also drew upon this historic and grand language of serious detriment and essential to the child's safety, but they did not tie this all together with the fact that there still are statutory requirements establishing the best interest of the child as the guiding or decisive factor.
Well, so to the extent then that the BLJ decision inserted a separate judicial step in the process that is divorced and separate from the best interest of the child, it did get it wrong. It needs to be overruled, or at least modified.
I think modified, because BLJ really, it's good law. It upholds that statute with per se finding of unfitness. I think, if I may be permitted a personal observation, I think when it talks about, it's towards the end of the case where it discusses Lemon v. Lorfeld, where it says, after the finding of unfitness, then the Supreme Court, or then the trial court discusses whether the unfitness is of serious detriment, et cetera. Lemon v. Lorfeld never really got into that. I think the standards articulated in Lemon v. Lorfeld and Markwell v. Perellis and back into the Merry Old England are actually met when 48.415, any of those are established.
Let me see if I can restate what I think your position is. You tell me if I'm right or wrong. What I think your position is that the trial judge, that this is a fact-driven determination.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that in some instances, what would be sufficiently egregious to determine allow for a termination would be in the best interest of a child, but in other instances, based upon the needs of the child or whatever, it might not be. And so this is really not a two-step process as much as it is weighing both the unfitness as well alongside of the best interests of the child to come out with a result. And that a finding of best interests of the child is not determinative. A finding of unfitness is not determinative, but it's looking at both of them together.
Not exactly. I believe it's the finding of the best interest of the child that is the decisive factor.
Well, what if the parents aren't unfit?
Oh, well, I'm sorry. That would have been after the finding of unfitness under 48.424. I'm sorry. Yes, that would be the first step, the finding of unfitness, the grounds for termination being established. And then once you go to disposition, then the best interest of the child.
Your position, I think, is that here, unfitness was found. That's the first step here. The jury did it based on the grounds. The court found it was unfit. Here, the court at its dispositional hearing, this is your argument, contrary to the statute, which says
the pole star of the dispositional hearing is the best interest of the child, that the court didn't even get to the best interest of the child. Instead, the court addressed a threshold step, and that threshold step was there egregious enough unfitness, if you will.
Yes,
and the
Your Honor.
Court didn't even get to best interest, but because it found that it wasn't egregious enough, dismissed it. And your position is, look, court, you have to address the best interest of the child. And if the parent's unfitness is only a little bit and really doesn't interfere with the child, maybe you don't terminate. But it is the best interest of the child that has to be addressed in the dispositional phrase. Is that what you're saying?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Though, of course, under State versus Kelly, yes, the trial court's decision was perfectly justified because he didn't have to reach the best interest under the Court of Appeals reasoning. So I'm asking that the trial court and the Court of Appeals both be redirected on that point.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Attorney Ronald J. Sonderhaus, representing Julie A. B.
Good afternoon, Justices. I'm Attorney Ronald Sonderhaus, representing Julie A. B. in this matter. I believe the state and myself are both in agreement that the best interest of the child has to be and is the pole star consideration that is taken under consideration by the trial court when framing a dispositional solution to a case that comes before it. The state actually frames the issue in their brief as whether and when the best interests are considered. I'd like to answer that question by saying I believe the trial court did consider the best interest in this case, and it considered it throughout making its dispositional conclusions. The trial court...
So you'll have to stay in front of the microphone to pick up the recording.
I'm sorry. The trial court was merely following established case law and precedent that had come down through other decisions, both from the Supreme Court and the Court of Appeals. In the BLJ case, the Supreme Court concluded that if the level of unfitness of a parent does not rise to the level of a serious harm to the child, then it would be in the best interest of the child not to terminate in that case. The exact language that the court was referring to was when concluding that a parent's unfitness does not rise to the level of egregiousness necessary to support termination, has already done an overview of the evidence, the findings, and also the implication of what is in the child's best interest. I want to touch on a point that Justice Abramson and Justice Babich hit on earlier. I believe the scenario was presented, what if the court, having already found the unfitness, also made the finding that it would be in the best interest to terminate the child, but what if that egregiousness wasn't there to do that? I don't believe that hypothetical or that situation could be presented. For if the trial court finds that the egregiousness of the parent's conduct does not warrant termination, then that is impliedly in the best interest of the child. However, if the court finds that it's in the best interest of the child to terminate parental rights, it has also done the reverse. It has found that parent's conduct is egregious enough and severe enough to warrant termination of parental rights.
Counsel, I'm confused, which is not unusual. I am failing to see the differences between your position and Ms. Taylor's position in terms other than semantics, that you both seem to be saying the same thing. How do you perceive your position is different from Ms. Taylor's?
I believe Ms. Taylor started with, or Ms. Wagner, I believe it was.
Ms. Wagner, excuse me.
Her position was that the trial court did not at any point consider the best interest of the child in making its determination that the parent's unfitness rose to the level of egregiousness.
Yeah, but I'm thinking about the overriding principle. How do you two differ in principle as to how a court should approach things? Not just this case, but for all cases in the future.
I believe the case law and the precedent that had already been established had been followed, and I believe the case in the Kelly case merely expounded upon the precedent that had already been set down and reached the trial court and the Court of Appeals reached the correct conclusions based on that case law and that precedent.
Counsel? As a further to this, if I may. I don't know if you've had an opportunity in looking and preparing for this case to look at what's referred to as our judicial bench books. Have you had an opportunity to look at that?
I haven't had an opportunity to do that.
Okay. Well, the bench book copy that I have dealing with involuntary TPI cites to Kelly S., and this is a 2001, so it's a pretty recent update of our bench book. And citing to Kelly S., it cites Kelly S., case suggests a third phase, finding of egregious unfitness. I interpret, now this is not the law, this is a number of judges, trial court judges, who get together and read the cases and, based on their interpretation, put this book together for trial judges to use on their bench, and that's why we call it a bench book. I interpret this phrase on the bench book JV 13-28, when they cite Kelly S., cited case suggests a third phase, finding of egregious unfitness, to mean that Kelly S., possibly, is introducing a third phase that is not just the best interest of the child, but rather a question has to be addressed before you get to that of whether or not the unfitness is egregious enough. Do you agree that's what Kelly S. did, or you disagree? What's your position with regard to the disposition involving a one or two prong analysis?
I don't believe that the Kelly decision necessarily put in a third part to the analysis of what's in the best interest. I believe that that's always been there. I believe Kelly was merely following or expounding upon the BLJ case in interpreting what is in the whether or not a parent's conduct is egregious enough to warrant termination as being in the best interest of the child.
What do you mean egregious?
Hypothetically, if you have a parent who, and as Ms. Wagner touched upon, a parent who has repeatedly harmed its child, beat the child, didn't feed the child, left the child alone for extended periods of time, and despite the interventions of the Department of Human Services, did not learn.
Let me give you a hypothetical, because that's what I thought you were talking about. Egregious being awful conduct of the parent. Probably one of the toughest cases I had as a trial court judge, and I still find it difficult, involves a woman, lovely woman, had twin boys. And this woman tried harder than anyone you could believe. But she had a real low IQ. You wouldn't know it if you talked to her just for a little bit, and she employed herself as a waitress. And she reached about as high a potential as she could with that low IQ. And she had these two boys, and these two boys were two boys. They were two toddlers, and she was okay handling kids until about age two or three, because she could rock them and she could hold them and she could feed them, and especially if someone checked on her, she could do that. She's a waitress after all. But there's no way that she had the wherewithal, the ability to deal with kids 5 and 6 and 7. They just outsmart her, to be quite blunt. Her conduct wasn't egregious. I mean, I admired that woman,
But there was no doubt in my mind that she wasn't competent. She wasn't capable of handling kids as they were 6 and 9 and 12 and, God forbid, 15 and 16. So what do you do with a case like that?
I'm surmising that the trial court in that position made the finding that her conduct would have been detrimental to some serious and important respects of those children.
Well, it wasn't egregious, but it sure was in the best interest of those kids that she not be they not be raised, those twin boys, that they not be raised by their mother.
And in that particular hypothetical, as those children get older, the parent did not have the coping skills or the parenting skills to deal with the adolescent issues or the increasing issues that those children would face. So in that particular case, the correct conclusion was probably made. In this case, we do not have those issues presented. Just the opposite had happened. At the time of the disposition, this mother was...
Well, except the trial court would not have gotten, under your theory, as I understand it, or I don't mean theory, under your argument, if you would say, okay, she's unfit, the jury said she's unfit, she is unfit. Was her behavior of those kids repeatedly harmful? Did she beat them? Did she leave them alone? That's how you decided egregiousness. If that's what the trial court would have had to found, the trial court would have said, no, her conduct isn't egregious, it's admirable. She just can't do it. And so therefore I won't terminate. I won't even get to the best interest. I'll let her try to raise those twin boys because her conduct isn't egregious. May not be in the best interest of the boys, but her conduct is laudable. What do you say to that?
I would argue that in that particular case, you have to conclude or theorize what might happen in the future in that particular case. And in this case, the judge concluded that the real test of how things were going to happen was what was going to happen when the mother was given the opportunity to finally get away from the jail setting. Ms. Wagner argues that you do not consider the child's interest when looking at it in that light and on behalf of the mother. But, on the other hand, because everybody would agree that raising a family is a fundamental right that should not be infringed upon a compelling state interest, that if the court determines that it's not in the best interest to terminate because the mother... her conduct is not egregious, then it must also be in the child's best interest to have that relationship with the mother. Now, those findings weren't specifically made, but that would be my argument.
Mr. Sangerhaus, I'm concerned about not just this case, but other cases in the future, and I'm wondering what this court, in your opinion, should do to avoid this kind of situation in the future. Do you think we should be telling trial judges that when they start getting into issues having to do with the best interests of the child, that they should specifically discuss the factors that are in 48.426? Is that necessary, do you think?
I don't believe it's necessary, but it could be helpful. That was not done in this case. The court didn't get to that step because they concluded that the level of egregiousness did not warrant termination, basing its finding on the BLJ case, which said that when it makes that determination, it impliedly has overviewed the evidence, reviewed the evidence, and come to that conclusion. Would it have been helpful? Possibly. Can't dispute that. Was it necessary? I don't think so.
Doesn't the statute mandate it by its terms?
Mandates it. In the case of the Joseph P. case, the trial court in that case did not exactly make picture-perfect findings, but nonetheless reached a conclusion that was not clearly erroneous, and that was upheld.
I mean, the statute speaks in terms of what the judge shall do in the dispositional hearing, and that includes the requirement that the trial judge shall consider the best interest of the child and shall consider the likelihood of the child's adoption after termination, the age and health of the child both at the time of disposition and, if applicable, at the time the child was removed from the home, whether the child has substantial relationships with the parent or other family members, and whether it would be harmful to the child to sever these relationships, the wishes of the child, the duration of the separation of the parent from the child, and whether the child will be able to enter into a more stable and permanent family relationship as a result of the termination. And those are factors that the statute directs the trial judge to consider, not that it may, but that it must. And it unquestionably wasn't done in this case because the trial judge read Kelly S. and BLJ as interjecting an intermediate step of evaluating the egregiousness of the jury's, of the finding of unfitness that had been entered into by the jury before getting to that.
That's correct.
And to the extent that that's what BLJ and Kelly S. stand for, there's no support in the statutes for that, is there?
Unless you read the BLJ language when that the judge, he may not specifically put those findings on the record, but those findings must, or those factors must go into his thought process when he enters.
Well, we can't get into the judge's mind. No, we have to base our decisions as reviewing courts on the record and what the judge says from the bench. And the judge unquestionably did not address any of those factors in this case. Isn't that right?
Can't dispute that.
Okay. As I understand the statutory structure here is that there are two phases, not three. There's a fact-finding phase to determine parental unfitness, and when there's a jury trial demanded, that's done by the jury, and the statute again speaks in mandatory terms. 48.424 sub 4 says, if grounds for termination of parental rights are found by the court or jury, the court shall find the parent unfit. So then that's mandatory. The finding of unfitness is proven, it's adjudicated, and it's entered by the court. And then the next step is the dispositional hearing, and 48.426 and 427 discuss the requirements at the dispositional hearing, and the factors that I just included are required factors at a minimum. The judge can consider more than that, but at a minimum, the legislature has unequivocally said that the trial court at that dispositional phase must consider those factors. Now, the judge is also going to put on the scales the unfitness that the jury has found and weigh and balance its level of egregiousness against all these other factors that the legislature has mandated trial courts to consider. But it's not going to put those that finding of unfitness and its level of egregiousness ahead of those factors. There's no statutory support for that, is there?
No, there's not. However, the only way to get around that result that you're would be to overrule the BLJ case, the way I'm reading it.
Or at least modify that portion of it which seems to interject this intermediate step of the trial judge engaging in a separate analysis of the jury's findings apart from the best interest of the child.
Right.
I mean, it seems to me that the legislature has made itself very clear about this best interest of the child standard, and to the extent that anything this court or the Court of Appeals has said to take that out of the dispositional phase of the process has got to be wrong.
However, using the case law as it currently stands, I would argue that the trial judge at least considered those, although not specifically saying how, in making his findings and determining that the best interests of the child would be served by not terminating the parental rights of this parent.
The trial judge, at the beginning of his ruling, quoted... of egregiousness of the unfitness before he looked to the best interest of the child. So that he couldn't. He read that case and specifically said he was reading that case as directing him not to consider the best interest of the child until he analyzed or evaluated the unfitness. So I don't know how you can read this transcript otherwise as implicitly considering the best interest of the child when the trial judge specifically said at the beginning of his ruling, page 3, that he was not going to consider that.
He did not consider those factors specifically. That's what he did not consider. That is true.
Well, he also considered himself precluded from considering the best interest of the child.
Those factors relate to best interests of the child.
Correct.
And when he says he's not going to look at those factors because he's not going to get there, because he's going to do, on page 3, essential finding on fitness, merely a finding termination is better, is not merely a finding, but essential to this their safety. That's the case. After this finding regarding unfitness warranting termination, then, he says, look to the best interests of the child. So what do you think that he actually did? I know you want to affirm the findings here, but what do you think he actually did here?
I believe that trial judge was acting under the precedent that had been set down in the BLJ case in reaching his conclusion that before you actually can terminate the parental rights of a parent, you must find that their conduct is detrimental or seriously harmful to a child before you can actually terminate.
And you think seriously harmful and detrimental to a child is the same as best interest of the child?
Yes, based on that case.
Not the statute, though.
Not necessarily the statute.
Well, if to clarify this, and, you know, I might get assigned to write this opinion, and so I've been trying to think of what would bring harmony here. So we're going to take out of the picture at the because we're going to assume that the jury has found it and the judge thinks there's sufficient evidence, okay? So we've got that finding. Now I'm at the dispositional stage, right? So what shall I write? And remember, we're going to set the law. We're going to clear this all up. What do you think I should write? Same question I asked opposing counsel.
Right. I would write that in making a determination as what is in the best interest of the child, the court shall consider the following, the factors enumerated under 48.426, specifically read in whether or not the analysis of these factors would be sufficiently egregious to warrant the termination of parental rights.
All right. Now, we start off with saying the statutory standard is best interest of the child. You say the statute, I'm sort of repeating what you said, the statute has the following factors. But that's not an exclusive list, right?
Correct.
So you want to then say the court can consider the egregiousness of the conduct in addition to the other factors?
I believe it can.
Okay. And do you want to say that we're going to look and see if the ability of the parent to function has been so seriously impaired that further contact between the parent and child will be seriously detrimental? Want to
Correct.
Say that? Okay. Those are all addition to the statutory.
Correct.
They're not ahead of the statutory.
However, having been in trial practice and appellate practice for 12 years, I know when you have factors that you are to consider or rules or guidelines that you are to consider, you can almost always tailor those to a conclusion that you want to reach, depending on how you put the spin on it.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if I would go as far as you did in saying that, but that's the whole point about discretion.
Right.
That is, the trial judge looks at these people, and on the basis of experience and the law, makes a decision. And when you say a judge has discretion, it means two judges might reach different results because they see this differently, and both are reasonable under the statute. Okay. But what I'm trying to do is see if you are going to push egregiousness, seriously detrimental, into the best interest of the child and into the statutory factors.
I believe it's already in the statute under 48.427 where the judge can dismiss a petition if it finds that the evidence does not warrant termination of parental rights, and then impliedly in that it considers all of the factors and other factors it may wish to consider in coming to that conclusion not to terminate.
Would you view that as at least a detour away from Kelly S. and BLJ?
A slight detour.
Okay. Can you still win with this detour?
I believe under the current current case law, I can.
What about with the detour?
Depends on how this court is going to frame the result or the remedy. With that,
it seems to me the state is asking for a remand here, and so if the state should win, there's still another hearing, isn't there?
I believe there would be another hearing, and assuming that the remand would entail the trial court addressing the factors that are listed under 426, that the judge would then have to evaluate those factors and make a new determination as whether or not to terminate as being in the best interest of the child. Perhaps after he did that, he would conclude that he should still dismiss the petition. We don't know, but he would at least have, I would assume, have to evaluate these factors.
Let me see if I can state a formulation of this. You have your fact-finding hearing. The legislature has determined what kind of factors show that the parent is unfit. And when the fact finder finds one of those things and the court says there's sufficient evidence of one of those things, then you move on to the disposition stage. And the disposition stage, the issue is the best interest of the child. Now, the egregiousness is, in effect, egregiousness means that the conduct of the parent or the findings in the last stage are inconsistent with the best interest of the child. And if you don't really have an egregious situation, you find something that is not inconsistent with the best interest of the child.
Correct.
Okay.
I think I understood it, but...
I'll say correct anyway.
Correct. We would basically be asking again, we would ask this court to affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals. We'd ask this court to find that Julie A.B.'s unfitness was not egregious to warrant termination and that the court's findings were not clearly erroneous, but the trial court did not specifically have to refer to each of the factors listed in 48.426 subparagraph 3, and that the trial court does in fact consider the best interest of the child when concluding that the parent's unfitness does not warrant termination. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Wagner?
I can't say I have any canned and snappy responses anymore for the rebuttal. I'll just try to hit a few points that were brought up by Mr. Sonderhaus. And just an overview of this, I believe the language of the termination statutes is crystal clear. The way that 48.424, the fact-finding, intersects and naturally segues to the disposition, which is governed by 48.426 and 427. The first time I ever read those statutes, literally, because I haven't been out of law school for very long, was after the trial court had made its decision in this case. First time I ever sat down and looked at the children's code, and I read those statutes, and it was perfectly clear to me what was required of a trial court, what the steps were. First, there was a fact-finding, then there was a per se finding of unfitness, then there was disposition governed by the best interest of the child. And there was no room for doubt when I saw the plain language of the statute. Now, in this case, it's obvious that, and from the record, as Justice Sykes has pointed out, the trial court read the case of BLJ and extrapolated from that the principle that he did not have to reach the best interest of the child under 426 because the unfitness was not egregious enough. Even assuming that he was drawing that correctly from BLJ, he still did not follow the language of the statute. That was completely ignored, and that was improper to have done so in this particular case. Mr. Sonderhaus,
Ms. Wagner, yes? Do you think that if we were to rule your way, we should require trial judges to go through those factors on the record and discuss each of those factors?
I don't think a
point-by-point discussion following the exact language of the statute would be necessary, but I believe that the trial court does need to leave a record that it has done measured consideration of those in some fashion, whether it's during the trial proceedings, whether it's during the dispositional findings. There are no magic words. As the statute itself states, these are not the only factors that that the trial court must or may consider. It's not subject to simply that enumeration. The trial court consider more, but at a minimum, it should consider at least those. But I don't believe that he has to follow a blueprint saying I've checked off sub A and sub B and sub C, as long as it's clear from the record that those things have gone into his thinking process.
Okay. You finished answering your question?
That question, yes.
Okay, I've got another one. I'm still trying to figure out what the fundamental differences, if any, there are between you and Mr. Sandrows. Now, I've heard that there is a difference between the two of you in that you believe the judge did not apply the best interest standard.
Yes.
Mr. Sandrows believes that the judge did. He didn't use the magic words, but nevertheless, the best interests of the child were taken into effect. Is that the only difference between your two positions, or is there a more fundamental difference of approach?
There are several differences, one of which his central argument is that the best interest of the child is established by implication. As long as the serious detriment and an essential safety language has been considered and discarded, therefore the best interest has been reached. And I believe that under the plain language of the Children's Code, under 48.01, which is the preamble to the Children's Code, the best interest of the child is so important it can't be reached by the back door like this. It is too important to be reached by implication or by default. I believe there's a minimum requirement of the trial court to meet the child's best interest head-on in its disposition, regardless of what the disposition may be, even if it's the dismissal of the petition. Where we also differ is to whether the Court of Appeals was correct in its establishing a two-part test of unfitness in Kelly S., which, of course, then drives the Court of Appeals' decision in this case. I believe there is no authority in the statutes for the creation of that two-part test.
The two-part test being first the judge determines whether
the egregiousness,
the egregiousness.
And then the best interest being reached. I believe there is no authority in the statute under the plain language in the statute, nor do I believe that was truly the intent of the Wisconsin Supreme Court when it issued its decision in BLJ.
Could I ask a question on procedure? And the fact-finding stage, is the state entitled to ask for a jury trial?
Mr. Hacker? My colleague actually tried the case. I don't know.
Good answer.
Anyway, shall I proceed? Okay. I just ask you to apply the plain language of the statute to this case and also with the reasoning of Kelly S. and remand this back to the trial court with direction that the best interest of the child control the disposition. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wagner. Thank you, Mr. Sonnenhaus, for presenting in both your briefs and in oral argument